So hi everybody, welcome to Tuesday morning and the final of this teaching called Don't Get Hooked, just based around the eight worldly concerns. So this begins, we normally do, by setting our motivation and doing a short meditation, saying the prayers, and then we go to the class itself. So as you know, during the class we have portions where you can stop and you can ask questions. And then there's also a part where we do some meditation as well. So please just get comfortable in your seat. Ideally, your back will be straight, your legs are in a comfortable posture, your hands are where they feel comfortable, and your shoulders are relaxed. You can close your eyes or keep them partially open, whatever suits you. And then let your body breathe itself. As the body breathes itself, just relax into awareness. From within the state of awareness, imagine the ground beneath you is made of a starry sapphire light, and the space above you is filled with rainbows and offerings. Directly in front of you, sitting on a lion throne, the cushions of lotus, sun, and moon, sits the Buddha Shakyamuni. And he's surrounded by an assembly of Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, deities, and other enlightened beings. Meanwhile, you find yourself surrounded by all sentient beings. Your mother is sitting beside you on the left, your father on your right. Friends and family are behind you. People you've had misunderstandings with and difficulties are in front of you. You recollect how fortunate you are to still be alive. And to have the leisure and opportunities to attain your spiritual goals. We all need to act quickly though, because things are not quite right. The world does not exist as it seems to. Nevertheless, we have come into contact with a spiritual friend who is leading us in the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones: the Buddha, our teacher, the Dharma, his teacher, and the Sangha, our spiritual companions. So to make this offering of practice as purely as possible, imagine yourself to be as clear as a deity. And you're holding a vajra and a bell within a sphere of greatness. From within the sphere of greatness, you go for refuge and lead all the sentient beings surrounding you in that same direction. So join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through this into the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through this into the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. In response to this wish of ours, imagine that from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectars stream down and dissolve into yourself and all living beings surrounding you. Negative karmas and obstructions are purified. Your health and lifespan are increased, along with your virtues and realizations of Dharma. So, cleansed by wisdom and love, recollect the four immeasurable thoughts. Then decide to develop these yourself and to establish all beings into those four states. To affirm this, join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. In response to this wish of ours, again, from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectars stream down. And these dissolve into yourself and all the living beings surrounding you. Then every negative karma and obstruction is purified. Your health and lifespan are increased, along with your virtues and realizations of Dharma. Having been purified with wisdom and fortified with compassionate love, exhale and just relax. And it's from that relaxed state of awareness the field for accumulating merit appears. They appear in the form of the Buddha himself, and very vivid and vibrant. And so you say in front of this image, Tayatam Rimi Mahamunayasa Tayatam Rimi Mahamunayasa Tayatam Rimi Mahamunayasa. You think by reciting the mantra you have control over the suffering of the lower realms so that you'll never find yourself reborn there. You also have control over the mistaken identity of who you think you are. This was for the second meaning. You have mastery over all sufferings and the self-cherishing thoughts. We say Maha Muni. We have great mastery over the subtle illusions and dualistic thinking. When we say the Soha, all the blessings and realizations of the mantra ripen upon ourselves and all living beings. And just decide in your own mind, you do want to develop your wisdom, compassion, every skillful method you possess to the perfect states, to accomplish the welfare of yourself and every other living being. And for that purpose, we're here studying the Dharma. Then, breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, and let your eyes flash open, and bring your awareness back into this room in your own time. Again, welcome. And so far, we've looked at two classes on these eight worldly concerns. So what have I written? I introduced the eight worldly concerns, and we're focused on the gains and losses related to material security and the pleasure and pain of sensory experiences. So we've looked at what we possess and our feelings. They've been expressed in pleasure and pain and loss and gain. So that's what we've looked at. I've taken basically a lot of this material from this How to Practice Dharma by Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and there's a great section in the other book next to it, Science and Philosophy, on the type of equanimity they're saying is an antidote to the eight worldly concerns. So today's topics, we're going to be looking at reputation, and how that also can be sort of besmirched by grasping, clinging at that worldly concerns. Also, then our social standing. And finally, we look at the antidotes to the clinging and the aversion to the worldly dharmas concerned with reputation and social standing. These two pairs of mundane concern, reputation and social standing. So on one side, you can see we overestimate the delight. So that's more clinging. We're so good, we want to hold on. But on the other side, it seems so bad, we just want to get rid of it. And so you can see here, we overestimate our feelings of delight in terms of our reputation. And it's the same way in terms of praise and approval. On the flip side, of course, when these things don't happen, or when they're taken away from us, or we meet difficulties, we can become dejected. Usually, what happens is anger and upset. This thing keeps popping in my head, which is I've just finished the biography on Elon Musk. Right? So in 2021, he was the richest person in the world, and he was also really unhappy. He's really unhappy. So just from last week, we say yeah, wealth does not assure that we will be a happy person. Okay, so let's have a look at our first one, is reputation and fame and disrepute. So here we have a picture of a monk, and what he's trying to do is draw a picture of himself on this water. That's the surface. In fact, the water shouldn't really be still like that. It should be actually moving. The thing is, it's moving water. So imagine trying to paint anything on something that's moving all the time. It just turns out really messy, doesn't it? You're not going to get what you sort of paint. And this is to show us really how the impermanence, the reputation, our reputation, whether it's good or bad, never is stable. It doesn't sort of exist from its own side, so it's always there. Because as you know, you might have your mother might love you, but your boyfriend doesn't. He drops you, right? So you've always got one side looking at you being really good, but then on the other side, this other thing comes in. So nothing there is for certain. Now, just a few words about these fame and disrepute in terms of reputation. So these pair relate to reputation, as you can see, as they are the two poles of obsession concerning our social image, our status, and our recognition. Fame is a strong desire for a good reputation or popularity, which leads to elation when procured. Its opposite side, of course, is disrepute. So this is a fierce aversion to a bad reputation, a bad image, or being disparaged. Now, the thing to remember here is Nagarjuna gives you advice that says even highly spiritual people are still afflicted by their idea of reputation, and later on praise and blame. It's the same, no matter where we are and how well advanced we are. It's only when you reach the state of Buddhahood that actually it's done. Oh, yes, that's right. So remember last week we talked about these eight worldly concerns, and they have sort of there's you can speak about them in terms of different levels of depth about how we're afflicted by them. So the eight worldly concerns are something I call the black worldly concerns, the mixed worldly concerns, the white worldly concerns. Now this will come up in a couple of slides later. We sort of see it. So when we talk about the eight worldly concerns, we start with the easiest one, the most obvious one, which is called black. That's the concern where whatever you're doing is for this life only. So the gain and the praise, the pain and the pleasure, the fame, these sort of things. They have different, how you hold to them has levels of wrongness about it. So the first one is, if we just take this one here, reputation, right? I'm grasping at fame, for instance. So let's take somebody like perhaps Anybody famous who got quite upset about when their reputation might have been besmirched in some way?
Donald Trump.
That's right. So we've got Donald Trump, we've got Elon Musk. I was just thinking, so Johnny Depp was taken to court. We took Amber Heard to court. These sort of things, right? They're really concerned about their reputation, like here. Right? So that's the black side. It's really obvious. The same as us, you know, if someone does something that we against us that we think might really be at us, and we get quite upset about it. We think, well, why are you so upset? And the other think, well, is it about some future life? You go, no. Is it about liberation? No. Enlightenment? No. You go, well, it's about this life then, isn't it? So that's the black one. It's like real, it's the one we're going to be most afflicted by. Then when it comes to what they call white or that's mixed. So we've got black, that's the mixed, and then we'll come down to the white. So in the mixed, this is where the self-cherishing comes up. So I had an experience of this just a couple of days ago, where this person I was talking to got quite upset about something. You know, the way it manifested, I knew. I thought, Jesus, that's it. That's self-cherishing. And I was silly enough to point it out, of course, but he did not like it. But there you go. There you go. And it's got reputation too, you know. So I was, you know, I was sort of going like, I did like it, they didn't like it even more after that. So I had to shut my mouth. I wasn't going anywhere with this conversation, you know. That's the self-cherishing. And then, of course, when they call it white, there we have the self-grasping. So, you know, so the roots of our suffering are self-grasping. In the Mahayana, it's self-grasping, self-cherishing. They're both really important, but they focus on the self-cherishing part. There's a lot of focus on that. In the Buddhism that is not of the Mahayana, say, for instance, the Pali tradition and so forth, you wouldn't have that mixed one there. It just is black and white. So they go after the self-grasping. That's right. So the advice for us is do not be concerned too much with these things. Now, like Lama Zopa takes quite a different approach, right? He's very fierce about it. Dalai Lama is much more gentle. So again, you've got to think, well, who's the advice for? If I can bear that harsh advice that's straight up and down, fine, you take that. If you can't, you have to go to the gentle and gradually move your way across. And as Terry says, and I was pointing out one of the first things I said was that it takes a long time to get rid of these eight worldly concerns. So he says that for us, as people like this, so it could be that if you read Lama Zopa's book, you could think, I can never practice Dharma then. Like, it's, you know, like you say to him, I'll never get rid of it. That one is, you know, you could, you know, oh my God. But His Holiness and Nagarjuna says, don't get involved with them too much. That's what his advice is, too much. So you, over time, you know, you'll gradually see the harm of these eight worldly concerns. And that way, you sort of move your mind away from them. You start using the antidotes and so forth. But please don't give up just because it looks terrible. Remember, it's all impermanent. It has no true existence. So in other words, we can work with it. It doesn't have to stay the way it is. Nagarjuna teaches that the issue is not, it's really not about having, how can you say, these eight worldly concerns. Because, you know, you could be famous. What if you were famous and you thought, oh my God, that's a terrible thing. So it's not being famous or being infamous or being rich or being poor or being feeling great pain or great pleasure. That's not the issue. It's clinging to them or being averse to them. That's the real issue. It's how your mind relates to fame. How does your mind relate to being praised? So that's what you have to check. And see if it's sort of, if you're engaging like too much, as the advice says. We have to do this, and so you have to sort of look at your mind. You have to, we can't see mind, with our eyes or anything. We know we have a mind, and we know we use it to think and feels, right? In relationship to these eight concerns, fame and praise and so forth, check what happens to you. Like when you're praised, someone says, "Oh, you're so good at doing this and that." Right? What happens? What happens inside you? Let's check. Being happy is not a problem. Being happy is not a problem. If you think you should always be happy, that's going to be a problem for you, because you won't be. Right? So, like I said, it's not happiness, sadness. These things are not the problem. It's how the mind is relating to them. We all have instances of sadness, don't we? Some of us get really depressed and might end up in a hospital, while others recuperate after a minute or so, don't they? So what's going on here? Sure, it's the mind engaging with its object. So I was thinking about this last night, actually. Your mind will make contact with an object, right? Whether it's an actual object out here in the world or one you're thinking of. That's the object, right? Now, when it makes contact with that object, one of the first things that happens is you're going to feel something. Right? So when you look at feelings, sometimes you might say, what are the causes of feelings? The answer is contact with an object. If the mind does not contact an object, you're not going to have any feeling. Right? It's simple as that, right? So, but when the mind makes contact with that object, the feelings that are going to come up are not really under your control. Right? You can't just decide, I'll feel really good about this, right? And then you do. It doesn't work like that, right? The mind just throws up the feeling immediately. And these feelings that are going to throw up are real pleasant feelings, unpleasant feelings, or neutral feelings. Right? And now you're going to engage in this called grasping. Right? So the feeling is taking place. Now the mind grabs that feeling and is going to think that this feeling, and it will always happen this way, is true. Your mind never tells you it's wrong. It's false. It'll always say it's true. And if you don't believe me, you check it out. You start thinking. Just start thinking. And see, everything you're thinking is true, isn't it? That's how it's going to appear to you. And often, so again, I had this experience again the other day. I said, listen, what your problem is, you think everything you think is true. And I went, Jesus, so I. Don't we? So that's so now what we're thinking. So now that the thing that we're grasping has what they call true existence. It's existing true, what's happening to us. And so we're going to behave as if these feelings are true. Right? If it's painful, we go, woof, get the heck away. If it feels great, come in. If it's neutral, what the heck? We just relax. So this is the process, and like I say, from a long, long time, it's going to be sort of unconscious. It just happens. Yeah, that's right, don't believe everything you think. And it's true, but that's as funny as it is. You say that, saying, yeah, you've got to think it first, and then you've got to refute it because it's already appearing true to you. And that's something to also remember, right? Whatever you think, it's going to appear to you to be true, whatever it is. Yeah. And so you will initially believe that. Until we do a lot of training using mindfulness, for instance, knowing what we're doing and how these things exist, we will always believe it's true. And the only way to really discover its falseness is not really conceptually, like I'm explaining. I mean, I'm explaining it to you. I hope you get it and go, yeah, it seems like that. But to try and stop it, you will not be able to stop it just with the knowledge of it. So I was talking to some people and I asked, just because I know a little bit about, let's say, horse racing, right? I can win every time, or ride a horse, I can't. So it's the same here. You can know about it the higher the whole process works, you try might find you can't do it, even though the understanding is correct. So it takes a long time to become good at this stuff. So for us now, we're going through the first stage of what they call, Dharma learning, which is you're listening to me, so you're hearing it. And while you're sitting there, I can see you thinking about it. Right? And that's how it works, right? We go hearing, thinking. Once if you're sitting there thinking, Jesus, I think he's right, and you try it out, think, I'm going to try and think something and see if I can actually, when I think it, see if it appears to me to be wrong or false. It's impossible, isn't it? You should go, no, nothing is saying that. Nothing affirms that what I'm thinking is wrong. From its appearance, it's wrong. It's never like that. It's always right. So you have to unpack it. You sort of analyze. And so this is the, in the reflective stage, we sort of analyze like this and go, okay, I think from what I've discovered, I think this is true. Now comes a long period of meditation. So it's just trying to familiarize your mind now with this new knowledge. You say, whatever I think, I'm always going to think it's true. So the period that they call appearances and the way things exist are in conflict. But Geshe used to say this all the time. Just walk out of here with this understanding. Things appear one way, they exist another way. So when I'm looking at you, to me, you all appear, believe me, none of you appear to me to be impermanent. You all appear to be quite stable sitting there, right? That's the appearance. The reality is that none of us are stable. We're changing moment to moment to moment so fast our eye can't even perceive it. There's a discrepancy there. And it's the same with the mind. The objects that appear to the mind aren't actually, like I'm looking at you. So that's not what actually appears to my mind. If it were, you guys would be in here somewhere, but you're not. Right? So what appears is an appearance of you. And I believe that appearance is true to you. Your meditation should depend upon what you've thought about before and reflected upon. And before you do that, you have to hear the teaching. So it can't be just meditation. It's all three. When they say in the text, you say, we have to study. When Geshe says study, study, he doesn't mean just read. He doesn't mean just reflect. He doesn't mean just meditate. It means that you have to do all three.
Yeah.
Yeah, contemplate, in other words, like think about this, argue about it, like get it settled in your own mind that this is true, this is the fact. But then you become familiar with that fact through meditation. Meditation is like cultivating that fact, becoming really familiar with it. So now that this is the way you walk about in the world, this is your view. But again, it's not things like fame or money or wealth or pain or anything like that that's actually the problem. It's how we relate to them. If we relate with clinging and aversion to them, we're going to have difficulties. The more deeper, the harder we cling or push away, the greater the difficulty will be. The less difficulty. Says, look, becoming obsessed with having a good reputation, becoming obsessed with having wealth, becoming obsessed about your illness. That's the problem, not the illness, not the fame, not the money. It's the obsession. And sometimes you might have met some people who are pretty obsessed about these things. I'm thinking, I know I have. It's really difficult being around those people. It's really hard to sort of try to move them off their way of thinking. They don't even realize that it's their way of thinking that's causing all this distress. They can't see it. Because for them, the problem is out there. This is another thing which will pop in the slides. Over time, try and get your head around this, to think, come to a conclusion, there are no problems out there. Any type of problem has to be coming from my own mind. Again, you can check this. So, okay, I'll ask you guys. If you said, if I said you've got all our problems are out there, right? There you go. Yep. Okay. I said, don't find me one. You'll never find a problem out there. There aren't any out there. That's why. Why aren't there any out there? Because problem is made up by the mind. It's a concept. It's a thought. You won't find it out there. It's as simple as that. It's the mind that determines where it is, whether we've got problems or opportunities, where these things are good or bad and so forth. Okay, so now, in terms of how to deal with these, you would have seen this again like last week, but I've put it up again. So when we start off with this idea of renunciation. So what are we renouncing? Clinging or grasping and aversion. That's they're the things. It's, like I said, it's not the objects, it's these mental ideas, the concepts. So we start off small, and the number one antidote here, and you can run this right through from the beginning to the very end, is impermanence. Right? Because our thoughts are, Ruby, you said our thoughts were adventitious. That's right, they just come and they go. Maybe they just come and go, they're impermanent. They cannot stay. It's impossible. This goes for anything that's a product. So thinking is a product. Anything you see with your eyes, hear with your ears, smell with your nose, they're all products, which means they're all subject to change. So we can use this idea, we go, oh, when you have pain, you know your pain will change, right? When you have wealth, you know how being wealthy will change. It never stays stable. You spend money, what goes down? You get some more, it goes up. Yeah, so you can run impermanence right through these the small stages of the path into the middle and into the great. And here I've got the four thoughts that turn them to the mind, to the Dharma. So here these were unfortunate human rebirth, death and impermanence, karmic cause and effect, and the faults of cyclic existence. All those topics, impermanence runs right through them. It don't matter. And you can use impermanence here in its, your knowledge of its gross states and its subtle states. Gross states, really simple, means you can see it with your own eyes, or if you, impermanent, you can eat it. It just goes. It's obvious to you. Chairs break, people die. That's gross impermanence. That's all. Running all the way through is what we call subtle impermanence. When the first moment is gone before the second moment arises. Anyway, so we can use material from our Dharma studies in this section. We can also use it now, but the big renunciation, the cyclic existence. Now we can use karma and selflessness. We can bring those two ideas in. Before, it's just impermanence. Then we move up to the great stages of the path. Now we can use impermanence, equality, emptiness, and giving and taking. So we have even more methods to use. And finally, of course, we have emptiness. So this wisdom realizing emptiness, this also runs through everything. We have impermanence and emptiness. We can't separate these from any produced phenomena. And these eight worldly concerns are all produced phenomena. So they're all subject to impermanence, they are all empty of the intrinsic nature. So there's like our bottom line. So let's go see what we've got here. Now there's a lot of writing. I mean, I didn't expect you all to sit here and read it up there. This is just for like if you want to go along and grab it out, you've got a poster there or something like that. You can look at it in your own time. So you can see here, I've used the principles of renunciation and impermanence go through the small and middle scope. And here, like I said before, you can use your understanding of perfect human rebirth to work against fame and infamy. You can use your understanding of death and impermanence to work against fame and its opposite. You can use your understanding of suffering and its nature again. So you've got all these different things you can do. So what can happen here is that although you have many different things you can do, it's also possible that you can't do any of them. So, you know why that is? Here's, I've got all these answers, right? So, oh, yeah, I know the answer. Great. I've got my little check sheet in my pocket. Whenever I get into trouble, I can whip it out and go, yeah. But it doesn't work like that. Yeah. It's like you've got to have, yeah, I'm trying to get, you've actually got to have taken one of these solutions and become familiar with it. As I said, it's the meditation part, right? You go along here, you look at this, you read it. So that's the first part, the study. Now you think about it. You go, oh, yeah, that's it. That's, yes. Pursuing fame does distract me from genuine spiritual training. See, who's famous? Trump. Is Trump a good meditator? Maybe not. Maybe about money, but not about his relations with people and alignment. Fame is certainly distracting for him. What about Elon Musk? Yeah, no chance of him doing that. You find any person who's interested in their fame, they are not interested in the spiritual path. But the fame is about this life. That's what, one of the choices, you remember the story of the Buddha? Yeah, that sage came, excuse me. Now, the sage came and gave a premonition to his father, the king. His king wanted to know what would happen to my son, right? And the sage said, well, he could become a world ruler. But meaning, in other words, like the old times, they just conquer everybody and you'd be the king. He could be that. Or he could be this great sage who leads people to awaken. So, of course, the king, thinking of the fame of it, like my son, a world ruler. That's what he wants, right? There you go. There's grasping the fame, right? So if he were to do that, there's no way he could go up the spiritual path. There are other kings, other stories of kings where the kings were not so interested in fame. They were kings already. They didn't need to be famous kings. They became really interested in what happens at the end of this life. What's going to happen to me? But then, in that way, they became less interested in fame and more interested in Dharma, like having some sort of protection at the time of death. So anyway, you can see here, like you can use lots and lots of stuff in the Dharma, and find something that will work for you. So when you find the, what often happens is you sort of, you read it, and then something might jump out and you go, wow, like, it gets you. And then that's the one. So just, like, think about it more and more, remember it, say it, and sort of walk around in the world, look at the world, and say, if you can remember it, try and relate it to it, try and relate it to it. Yeah, then you'll have some sort of protection for yourself. Believe me, it's not uncommon to know a lot of Dharma and yet be unable to use it. And it's not a bad thing because it'll shock you so much you'll decide, gosh, I'm back, like, what happened? Right? Why wasn't I able to protect myself? I know all about Dharma. So when this happens, please don't be discouraged with yourself because this is another thing that often happens. You find you can't apply it, so now you blame yourself. That's no good either. It just means you haven't trained yourself. You've got to find something that will work for you, become familiar with it, and then apply it. When the stuff hits the fan, it's like, now's the time, right? If it's already hit the fan, you're going to find it very difficult. It's very, very difficult to step back from something once you're in it. If the emotions are too strong, you won't be able to. You can sort of break apart, then you can use your antidote. So this is hard. Like I say, even though we know broken legs can be repaired, it's better to not break your leg, isn't it? So it's the same with the Dharma. It's better to just, like, know what to do rather than get wounded, get your way back up, and start again. And yet, this is not uncommon. So, like I say, you can find plenty of antidotes to deal with reputation within renunciation, bodhicitta, and the view. But there are three major pillars, so to speak. You go, wow, all the teaching about renunciation, go from here to here, I can find antidotes for myself. If I'm more drawn towards the middle scope or the great scope, great, you'll find more antidotes there too. Okay, 6 foot. Just a quote by a great French philosopher. So this is what he says. Well, in fact, a man is not hurt so much by what happens as by his opinion of what happens. So, yeah, a person is not hurt so much by what happens as by their opinion. This is not, this is a truth that goes right across, and you'll see the Buddha did it, Shakespeare did it, Montaigne did it. There's so many great philosophers, they all came to the same conclusion. It's not the things out there. It's the relationship your mind has with them. Yeah, that's what I mean. You find something and you go, wow, that's true. Right? And then you become familiar with it. So that when these things start to happen, you've got something to grab onto. But that's what Dharma is, what you hold on to protect you from suffering. As you see, as you go through the kit, there's all these little pithy sayings, quotes and things, just like this one from the Frenchman. But you can, the idea is to grab one and become familiar with it. Yeah, this is the truth. I've just got to abide in the truth and I'll be okay. So the core idea here, of course, is that suffering doesn't come from events, but from the opinion of what happened. Right? This is Montaigne's idea. The Buddhist idea is that problems do not exist outside the mind. Our mental attitude will either transform a situation or make the situation something. So, anything interesting you'd like to add to this? The other thing I was concerned, I went home and I went on my AI and pulled out the poem If and asked for a non-gender explanation of it. And it got all these different paths that relate to the Buddhist teachings. It's like, of course. And what I noticed, that of course, he said, yeah, so Kipling was really influenced by Stoic philosophy and Buddhist philosophy, because he was in India, of course, when he wrote this poem. Okay. Yeah, again, so it's the response to their perception of you. It doesn't matter that they have the perception of you as that way. It's wrong. This just happened to one of our students a couple of days ago. Same thing, he's made all these changes by being here. He met somebody from his past, and this person sort of spoke to him as if he was like a deadbeat, he's blah, 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 and so forth. This person got quite upset because wasn't who he was anymore. Again, that's like clinging to your reputation, isn't it? I'm not that fool, I'm something more than that now. So you grab itself. Yeah, so this is a big thing that with Buddhist philosophies, there's very little you can do about ch changing the external circumstances. I mean, you can, of course, we can do it, but it doesn't make a great deal of impression to the mind. Yeah. So if we change our mind, it doesn't really matter how people relate to us. We stay the same. We don't get swept away by their praise or their derision. But we're fine. So one of the antidotes that they give to this is you think that whenever anybody speaks to you, you think it's just like an echo. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. There's no problems out there. So if you take the idea, there's no problem out there. When they say these things, you go, that's not a problem. Problems come from here. I make problems, not you. You know how hard it is, difficult it is to change anybody's mind. It's hard enough to do it on our own, let alone try and change anybody else's mind, isn't it? Very hard. So, if we make this division between, let's say, ordinary people who know nothing about the Dharma, and people who do know something about the Dharma. Well, Montaigne, Shakespeare, these guys are not Buddhists, but they knew Dharma, because Dharma here is just truth. So if you take this here, a person is not hurt so much by what happens, right? So if you have this person criticizing you or saying things that are untrue about you, that is happening. But what's your opinion about it? Because that's where the hurt comes. Like you say, all you have to do is not like it, and you're hurt. That's it. If you say, oh man, this is great, tell me some more. And you might do that. And just keep feeling like, how hurt am I getting with these words they're saying to me? Geez, not much difference. Not much is happening. God, say some more. Yeah. But one more thing. So, in fact, there's this great, in the book, I just finished this biography of Elon Musk. Oh, he had a horrific childhood. So they'd say it was a story there where he was beaten so badly by his kids at school, he had to spend a week in hospital, come out and everything, bruised and hurt. And so he comes home and sees his father, and his father says, "Good job, you deserve that. Who do you think you are to call people stupid?" Kept him there for 2 hours and berated him. Guess what? How he's like now? He'd go, "No matter what people say to me, I make my own decisions. Your words mean nothing to me." This is how he had to work with his father, standing there for hours being berated. What are you going to do? I mean, most people get really upset, don't they? Get really angry, and then there'll be this sort of thing where you sort of like give up. You just sort he's a kid, right? His dad's a big fellow. What, you're going to try and argue against your dad? Yeah, then he's going to whack you around too, so that's not going to work. But he didn't. He sort of used it as this way to go, like, no, I'm right. But you're wrong. And that's what he did. And so he cultivated this because he kept running into people who hurt him and yelled, this is a nerd. So people didn't like him and misunderstood him and criticized him and did all this. And he said, so it's not that they say all these things, it's the response. It's your response that hurts you. It's not that. One of the things, like I said, from my own experience here, is all you have to do is not like it. And the rest follows, man. You just go down the gurgler. But you could train yourself to go, "I like it." You can. Anything that happens that you don't like, just go, "No, I like it. I like it." And then I might say, "Why?" And then you have to have a reason, don't you? But just saying it, hey, yeah, you might go a little way with that, but not too far. You have good reasons for liking it. Yeah. So one of the great reasons for Dharma, you go, "This, I love it." Why? Because he's helping me cultivate renunciation towards suffering. He's making, he's yelling at me, saying all these nasty things and so on, but my mind doesn't believe it. It's like I said before, what normally happens, you hear it, you believe. That's the grasping. Contact, feeling, grasping, belief. Don't grasp, just go. Don't believe, you might be just empty words. Yeah, so here, this stuff is primarily for Buddhists. We're working as Buddhist solutions, because you have to have the understanding impermanence and selflessness, impermanence and empty. So normal people, a woman 78, you're not going to have any understanding of that. In fact, for that sort of thing, you might have been hereditary. There was another student who had the same problem. First of all, he tried being a Buddhist, that didn't work. Then he tried being a Christian, that didn't work. You know what worked? No, he moved house. He goes somewhere else where there's no dogs. Yeah. So the first thing for ordinary people like ourselves is like, can you remove yourself from the situation? If you can, do it. You don't need to put up with this crap, right? When you remove yourself, don't think badly of the person, because that's a great cause for you to have more of it. That's karma, right? Don't think badly of them. Yeah, all that stuff. What you want to say is, they forced me to engage in Dharma. Right, thank you very much. So you use these people, these bad things, as teachers. That's from the monoscope. Didn't.
So my dad's a bit of a character. He's Irish, but he's not Buddhist. But he had a like growing up, I remember because he worked overseas, he had a bit of a weird reputation. People would say things that were quite unsavory about him. And what I discovered over the years was he actually cultivated that disrepute because it helped him do business overseas because that was a particular culture. So he, instead of letting it get him down, he would go, oh, this is a resource, and he found a way to use the all the talk of the stories because it became
incorrect
publicity,
perceptions of it,
and it helped his business. So
yeah, that's right. And yeah, there's plenty of stories, whether they be Buddhist stories or you know, non-Buddhist stories, about people who have been in horrendous situations. And you cannot change the situation. So the only thing left is to change your mind about it. And that's what got them through. And those others who just look at the situation as being nothing, they perished. So, you know, so that might be like one of the wonderful things, isn't it? When you're stuck in these situations, you go, now you have to do something, right? Or you're going down. And what is it? Well, you can't break through the walls, you know, you can't convince the other people to speak to you differently. Yeah, that's all right. Okay, just change your own mind about it. What's interesting, that's so interesting. Let's meditate. So do it, this first meditation. Let's get comfortable in the seat. Drop your shoulders. If you like it, you can close your eyes, otherwise keep them open. And just breathe normally and naturally. Just bring your full attention gently to the sensation of the breath at the belly. We need to cultivate an altruistic, balanced mind. Mind is free from the anxiety of seeking approval, to finding stable peace for ourselves and others. So recollect a recent time when you grasped at a good reputation. In other words, believed in a good reputation. Recollect a recent time when you had a strong belief about a good reputation, or else felt terrified of becoming notorious. And just simply notice how that feels in the body. So let's imagine you have this great reputation, people surrounding you, patting you on the back, thinking you're just wonderful. How does that feel? Doesn't it feel good? Okay, then just try and just let that go. And then imagine feeling sort of terrified because someone knows something that you don't want them to know about you, and you're afraid they'll share it with the world. People, in other words, have a bad opinion of you if it were known. How does that feel in your body? It often feels so unpleasant and we don't like it. So again, just notice when you felt this response in your body towards being towards fame or this good reputation. Fame often appears to be something really permanent, long-lasting, and sort of solid in a way. That fame is merely a collection of fleeting opinions that cannot provide a reliable security for you. Think of the famous people who have been assassinated, or the famous people that every week somebody goes up online or on Twitter and denigrates them. But being famous is not reliable as a form of defense or security. So when we chase status or fear disgrace, we're often driven to deceit and anxiety. And this deceit and anxiety create negative habits that will trap us in dissatisfaction. The reputation itself is like a dewdrop or a drop of dew poised on a blade of grass. It sparkles beautifully in the morning light, but is unstable and vanishes the instant the sun rises. So now, what cognitive error, in other words, what wrong thinking do you have? What is the wrong thinking that transforms the neutral words into elation or dejection? What transforms words into feeling great about hearing them or feeling really depressed and down about hearing them? So we reify these empty sounds. In others, we make them more real than they actually are. Yet, like a dewdrop trembling on a leaf, the praise evaporates the moment it appears. So why is the pursuit of fame logically unsound regarding our mortality? So fame offers no protection at the time of death. Our fame dries up as swiftly as the morning dewdrop under the rising sun. So when the impulse to defend your reputation arises, what does this reveal about your sense of self? It reveals a mind grasping at an ego that feels real and solid. But in fact, it's as fragile as that fleeting drop of dew in the morning light of wisdom. Let's rest in that insight and release attachment to the opinions of others. Just rest in the freedom of the unshakable truth of your own inner stability. Breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth. Eyes open. So now we come to this next worldly concern of social standing. And here we're looking at clinging to praise and aversion to blame. So these pair, sometimes called approval and criticism or disapproval, these two are really intimately related to our social standing because they represent the core of mental factors through which ordinary beings constantly seek validation and confirmation of their perceived worth within society. Praise is a desire for approval and accolades, elevating our perceived standing, while blame is the rejection of criticism or derogatory words, which threatens to diminish our image or reputation. But again, the pursuit is futile because words of praise and criticism are merely designated by name and concept and have no true existence. So it's funny, while I was talking to them, wow, it's true. Like you speak words, they're like I'm writing on water. Anybody ever written anything on water? You ought to try it. It disappears as you write. You know, you write the thing, the stroke goes up, and you go, there's your M, there's nothing there. At the end, and you go down like this. And if you look at thoughts, they're like that too. I mean, and words, you speak them, like they're gone, aren't they? Like, just in there, that moment you hear them, they're finished, they're gone. But what we do is like, they're gone, but we hold on, we grab them. And that's called grasping, right? When you hold that thing and then you go, okay, now what's the meaning? Do you think the word has an intrinsic meaning? It doesn't. Meanings are given to words. Words are made up by us. The meaning isn't in them. We have to say, this word, what does that mean? Oh, it means this, and then we add that to And now suddenly we hear it, we grab the whole lot. It's one and the same thing to us. Now we're in trouble. Like I said, you believe it. You're going to believe it. You grabbed it, you held it. It's real for you. You get the effect. Again, I've drawn up another table like this. Again, it's just a way of like finding solutions within all the teachings of the Dharma, you know. So like I said, you can look for teachings in the small step, the middle step, the great step. You can look for teachings in renunciation, bodhicitta, emptiness. They're all there. It's just for you to find the one that suits you. You just find where you are in your own development. Try and be as honest as you can about this, because if you take something that sounds great, but you're not actually up there with the mind, it won't work for you. It'll just be, like I said, empty words. The thing is not there for you. Yeah, again, so it's all impermanent and empty. And then within those two, then you've got all these different stages you can go through and find solutions that work for you. Okay, so again, we have this new, another quote. This is from Hamlet. So some of you might be familiar with this. It's real common, right? There's nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Again, right? Yeah, so we've got lots of Western philosophers from many different countries. You invite Eastern philosophers, they've all come to the same conclusion. And again, it's like I say, if you take any object, like I said, there is nothing either good or bad, right? So here we've got something. Let's take this something called a clock. Now, is it good? Like, what? What are you talking about? What a funny question. I'm just asking, is it good? You just say, yeah, it worked. Right? That's all you're going to go. Just say yes. And then start looking. And please, I can't find any good in here. I find all sorts of different parts of a clock, but nothing called good. Right? So yeah, it's not an object. So where's it coming from? Thinking. Thinking makes it good. Thinking makes it a clock. So you can sort of see here, it's really important to work out how you think. Because your thinking is going to create the suffering or happiness. It's like I said, it's not out there. It's not like X-Files. Say that. Yeah. Yeah, so again, so what I did with this, just for my own fun. I take things like this and I get the AI to give me an explanation on it, and then I'll look it across and go, now what is the relationship to the Dharma? And see what they say about that. And what are the correlations? You put it all together and oh yeah, good. Just gives you sort of not depth, because the depth really comes from the meditation, but more to think about in terms of the analysis, the contemplation. So here's the question, huh? If praise cannot increase your lifespan, all the good deeds you've ever done, or your health, so praise cannot increase and criticism cannot destroy them, what exactly is being gained or lost when your reputation changes? Their external reaction to you is being lost. If praise cannot increase your lifespan, your merit or health, and criticism cannot destroy them, what exactly is being gained or lost when your reputation changes? I think we all know, but no one's going to say it. What's the answer? Nothing. Nothing substantial happened at all. Nothing at all.
Nothing else.
No, that's right. Nothing substantially. This fame doesn't, or probably these things aren't substances, right? They're conceptions. They're concepts. They're ideas. What do you think about others' reactions? That's your reputation. That changes your reputation. So your reputation changed because, wow, Jesus, don't go along with that, folks. Ever. Because then take the opposite side, Terry. Take the opposite.
Well, because your life's changed.
Okay, so that's the worldly view, right? Because though the worldly view is things have substance. So this is this thing I've been talking to as a student overseas. So it's really, and this is, I think, fantastic to me. So you know, our thinking is basically long on Greek thought. You guys know that in terms of historically thinking, how we think, it basically comes from the Greeks, right? And all the way up till now. It's been going undergoing changes and all that sort of thing, right? Yeah, that's it. Done. So the Greeks were around what time? Before Christ, right? From there, right up. So their way of, so they were analyzing like the world, right? Just like everybody did. Like, who are we? How do we exist? Yeah? I think it was Plato, and who was Plato's student? Socrates. Yeah, I think it was Socrates is the guy who took the thing, the hemp. No, it wasn't Socrates then. It's Plato and this other guy. Anyway, one of these guys, right? So they're looking at the world, and they're trying to work out how does the world exist. Their answer was that things have an essence. And ours. And ours, Terry. It came right up through, you look back all the hundreds of years, so what are we looking at there for the essence of things? Yeah, but this is what I'm saying here. I'm talking about one side of civilization, right? Our country is not a Buddhist country. Every Western philosophy country, right, has been affected by the view of essence. Buddhism went essence-less. There is no essence in anything. So nowadays, of course, our modern physicists have discovered also the essenceless nature of phenomena. Phenomena do not have essences. So here we've got, like, sorry, wow, what a great thing. So on one side, we're grasping at real things, things with an essence. On the other side, these things have no essence. So now we've come across from the side of everything has essence, real self in here. Essential self, right? Real self. Yeah, everything is a real. Buddhists look at that and go, well, if there's an essence, where? And they don't find any. It's a completely different view, isn't it? They're completely different. In fact, they oppose one another. So it's like looking at the things of the world. They have a thingness. This is what they mean by essence, essential nature, a thing. So I think, okay, so we went to school like that. We were brought up with that sort of idea. I remember I was really confused at school because it seemed that things have essence, and I'm like, I don't get it. Anyway, I'm just sort of saying now we've got this different way of looking at this way. So it can be quite difficult to make the shift. That's what I'm sort of saying. The only way you'll actually make the shift is to analyze yourself. To see if the phenomena have an essential nature, an essence. If they don't have, then you can be sure, right, they have no essential nature, yet they exist. Just because they don't have an essential nature. And the Buddhists go, if they had an essential nature, here's all the problems. So we don't go along with that. And we don't find an essential nature when we look into the phenomena. So now, if things had an essential nature, then they would be good or bad. Now, we use these terms, like, is it good? That's what we talk about, the nature of the thing. Is it good? And that's like saying, has it got a good, is its nature essentially good? We say, yeah or no. But it doesn't actually have that. That's a conventional understanding. Good and bad exist conventionally, not essentially, not ultimately, as other philosophers have thought. So then I went on, I'm doing this, and I thought, wow, so 1970, this great philosopher, I think it was German, from Heidegger. So he was the same. He came to this idea, wow, there's no essential nature in anything. And then, as we know from the science side, they've also found out the same sort of thing. That whatever does exist depends upon a measurement. So you're going to ask something about that? Yeah, most people do. Ordinary people do. That's exactly how normal people think. That's right. That's the normal way of thinking. The thing is it true? You don't have to just go, yes, sometimes. But it doesn't have to be true, does it? So yeah, there are plenty of stories throughout history where people have denigrated fiercely, told they're stupid, they can't do it, what the heck are you talking about? No? They're seen as a lot of pushback on them. Like, I'm just thinking of it like, what's the name, Marie Curie, for instance. Man, you read her biography, boy, oh boy, what a difficult life she had. And did she let all this denigration about reputation come to her? No. She realized it didn't matter. What really matters is helping people, not my reputation. But you're quite right. So here's the difference, right, between ordinary people who have no knowledge of Dharma and Dharma people. So this idea, it's a hard thing. Like I said, the Buddha also said, this is what makes it hard. My teaching goes against the stream. So the way the stream flows is the ordinary way of thinking. It's easy. And he goes, I've got this Dharma. It's not easy. It means looking at these phenomena and asking these deep questions, analyzing. Again, so it's meditation. And you just get comfortable in your seat. We're going to try and cultivate an equanimity that is not swayed by the desire for approval or the fear of disapproval. And that way, finding freedom from the eight worldly concerns. So recollect the recent time when you felt elated by a compliment or crushed by a critical remark. So do one first and then do the other and just observe the reactions that take place in your body. How do you feel when you feel elated by a compliment? And how do you feel when you're crushed by a critical remark? Now, we suffer not because of the words spoken, but because we cling to a self-image that we desperately want others to validate. We mistake the approval of others for our reality, forgetting that our true nature is not defined by external opinions. This dependency makes us fragile. It causes us to give our power away to anyone who speaks to us. So praise and blame are like an echo in a canyon. They seem to come from a really solid source, yet if you search for them, they're empty and vanish instantly. So ask yourself, why do we let short-lived sounds, which are devoid of meaning, determine our happiness? Well, basically, we mistake the fleeting vibrations of sound for reality. But like an echo bouncing off a cliff, these words lack any intrinsic power to help or harm us. So if praise cannot increase your lifespan or health, and criticism cannot destroy your merit, what is gained or lost? So nothing substantial is gained or lost. The pleasure or pain is as fleeting and unreal as a child's death in a dream. It leaves no trace upon waking. So when you grasp at approval, what are you holding on to? You're grasping at an illusion. Approval appears to be real, but ultimately there's nothing there to hold. So just rest in the absence of grasping. Let the words of others just pass by like wind through space. And releasing your attachment to the opinions of others, just find stability in the unshakable truth of your own awareness. And you're breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth. And let your eyes flutter open. So just got a few minutes here. So this here is this picture called, you know, the false of arrogance. And what it's a story about is a great Buddhist monk called Ben Gundrell. He used to be a robber and a thief. And you know, he changed his life, became this monk. And this picture is one of the stories. So one time he was you know, walking in the mountains and so forth, and he came across a house and he yelled out, "Hello, hello, anybody there?" Nobody's there, so they're out there. So he goes inside and there's like a jar of food there on the table. Right? So he's hungry and thirsty. Right? So he undoes the top, he puts his hand in to grab the food, and he realizes what he's doing. So he grabs his hand and he says, "Stop, thief, thief." He just yells it out by across the room, and he's holding on to his own hand. So he's not afraid, right, to show up his mistakes. That's what he's sort of saying. So he says, like, sort of be humble and don't be arrogant, because being proud basically stops your learning. You think you already know, so you can't learn anything more. One of the things that arrogance, of course, you do this, you don't care all that much about the feelings of others. Your own feelings are more important. And then, of course, people do avoid your company. I don't think many people like being with arrogant people, or they find it very difficult to be with them, that's for sure. And this sort of thing, don't be complacent about this. So pride is one of the chief obstacles to increasing wisdom and developing an inner potential. Believing ourselves to be learned, talented, and excellent, proud people are self-complacent. They just, you know, I don't need to do anything, I'm fine. Learning sort of flourishes when you're humble. Now, when you want to know, and you understand, like, I don't know, that's a sense of humbleness, right? Humility. You know, like, and I want to know. And that's, you sort of have to have this attitude when you come to Dharma. But you want to put it into your own suffering. You want to be happier, better person. And so Nagarjuna says again, gain and loss, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute and praise and disparagement are the eight worldly concerns. Equalize these so they are not objects of one's mind. Excuse me at the back there. So when you're talking about reputation, the idea behind this was to not be concerned too much. Doesn't mean don't be concerned at all about your reputation. You should be concerned about your reputation. But being concerned too much, that's where it gets problematic. Which, you know, we can't just drop our reputation. And that's not what's being asked of us either. We're not asked to do that. We're not to say, look, don't care about your reputation. It doesn't matter. That's untrue. It does matter. Those are saying, don't be concerned over much about your reputation. And the overmuch comes when you cling or you reverse. Then you know it's overmuch. We got a bit far here.
So, Eddie, are you saying it's kind of like a means to get to the destination? It's not the destination kind of thing. Like when you focus too much on reputation, that becomes the goal instead of tool to help you along.
Yeah, sure. This is the right thing, didn't it? Yeah, and so the way, so he's trying to say, yeah, the pillars of a stable well-being. So this is to help us work skillfully with the eight worldly concerns. We can use this mind of renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness. Like again, remember, because they're products here. Everything, all these things are impermanent, are subject to change. They have no true existence, meaning they exist in a different way that they appear to you. And bodhicitta, of course. Now, this is a really useful thing. I'm thinking of how I caught it. Yeah, what happened was this person, I could just see their attention slipped away from the other, concerned for other, and then it became clinging at themselves. Like, Jesus, there it is. What is that? Anyway, I was just lucky, I think, just to catch it like that. And then I read this other text that said, when you're training in this, use somebody else as your object, which is because it's easier. You know, but wow, that's the first time. And so I did it, you know. I thought, oh, this is what I used to do when I was a kid. Yeah. When my father behaved really badly towards me, I just said, I'm never going to behave like that. Yeah, so, you know, so it's like looking at somebody else, seeing their behaviors, and thinking, I don't want, that's terrible behavior. I don't want to be like that. That's renunciation, yeah. Decide, I'm not going to be like that. In fact, I want to actually help these people. And then you go to bodhicitta. Yeah, and that's possible because it's all empty. Again, I'm finishing off the core insight of all this material. Our suffering arises not from external events, but from the way your mind is interpreting them. Remember, there's another person I quite like, who's really quite a bit about. Who's the woman that said, Byron Katie? So her question is, she always goes, the first thing she asks, is it true?
Yeah.
Whatever happens to you, you ask, is it true? And then if you go, yeah, it is, yeah, are you absolutely sure? All right, have another look at it. Yeah, and then there's the last two parts of it where you've got the thought transformation involved in it. But it's a great thing to do. It's so simple, you know. Again, with mindfulness, that's your phrase. Where you hear somebody denigrate you or put you down or anything like that, just ask yourself, is it true? And if you say, no, it's not true, you know, you don't have to take it and hold on to it now, do you? It's just not true. Right? It's a really nice, simple way of quickly shutting this thing down. Right? So, you know, this wraps up our course on these eight worldly concerns. So basically, you should hopefully know what the faults of aversion and clinging are to any of these eight worldly concerns. Right? Like I said, it's not, again, always remember, it's not the problem with fame and pain and all these things. That's not the problem. It's how your mind is relating to them. So excuse me at the back there. You know, when those people denigrate you and put you down for what they're saying to you, if they keep doing that to you, like I said, and reputation too, you know, people trying to shut down your reputation, just ask yourself, is it true? Is it true what they're saying? If it is, no need to get upset, is there? If it's not, no need to get upset. Right? And there are all these antidotes, like I'm saying. So if you get into trouble later on or something and you just can't find one, right, it'll help you. But again, like there are a lot of them, you know. Like I said, go through all the stages of the path. If you like, run them into the AI and say, give me some solutions. And you'll find them. But obviously, if you're familiar with the Dharma, you won't need to do that. Okay, so let's have a look what we're going to do coming up. So if you want to study more about this, Lama Zobrin has got that great book, How to Practice Dharma. And then, of course, there are another book, Free Teachings, HDL Teachings from Tibet. There's another commentary in there on that, really concerns. December 24th, we've got our Christmas Eve puja coming up, and then on February the 3rd, we start a new course that will establish your daily practice. A couple more slides, maybe, and then we'll finish up. So we're going to dedicate now, and then maybe we'll finish up. So please join me in saying, Due to the merits of
Answer
these
these
virtuous
virtuous
actions,
actions,
thou
thou
quickly
quickly
attain the
attain
state
the
of a
state
good
of a
and
good
Buddha, and
and
lead
lead
all
all
living
living
beings
beings
without
without
exception
exception
into
into
that
that
enlightened
enlightened
state.
state.
May
May
the
the
Supreme
Supreme
Jewel,
Jewel,
Bodhicitta,
Bodhicitta,
and
and
not
not
yet
yet
born
born
arise
arise
and
and
grow.
grow.
May
May
that
that
born
born
have
have
no
no
decline,
decline,
but
but
increase
increase
forevermore.
forevermore.
And
And
as
as
long
long
as
as
space
space
remains,
remains,
as
as
long
long
as
as
sentient
sentient
beings
beings
remain,
remain,
may
may
I
I
too
too
remain
remain
to
to
dispel
dispel
the
the
sorrows
sorrows
of
of
the
the
world.
world.
For all this is long life. The
The
wish-granting,
wish-fulfilling
wish-fulfilling jewel,
jewel,
source
source
of
of
every
every
single
single
benefit
benefit
and
and
happiness
happiness
of
of
this
this
world,
world,
to
to
the
the
incomparably
incomparably
kind
kind
Tenzin
Tenzin
Gatso,
Gatso,
I
I
beseech
beseech
that
that
all
all
your
your
holy
holy
wishes
wishes
be
be
spontaneously
spontaneously
fulfilled.
fulfilled.
And
And
lastly,
lastly,
for
for
Rinpoche's
Rinpoche's
discovery, reincarnation discovery, there may be no problems with that. In holding and spreading the Muni's precious and complete teachings for explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you I make this request.